Bertaczynski Madison is president of Human Resource Solutions and author of the new book, Suddenly in Charge, Managing Up, Managing Down, Succeeding All Around. Join Ed and Roberta as they explore how extraordinary results can be achieved by creating work environments which allow workers to thrive.
Roberta, it's my pleasure to talk with you again today. And our topic for the conversation this morning is the exceptional workplace. What it is and how we can use the exceptional workplace in order to attain exceptional results, which is what everybody wants. All the stakeholders want exceptional results. The clients want exceptional results. The lawyers want exceptional results. And wouldn't you know it, so do the employees, because they want to feel better and know that they're making a contribution. So it's a joy for me to have you here today.
Thank you, Ed. Same here.
Let's start by my asking you the following question, and that is, what's the single most important behavior that a practice leader, a managing partner must perform in interacting with his or her people?
The single most important behavior is really being honest with their people. And what we see all too often in the workplace is that people aren't necessarily saying what they are thinking, and so that leaves employees having to guess. And sometimes, and when I say honesty, Ed, I don't mean, you know, walking up to somebody and saying, wow, that is the ugliest suit I have ever seen.
I was going to ask you what you meant by honesty, because even in marriages you don't have honesty. How are you going to have honesty in the workplace?
It means being truthful, you know, giving people feedback so they can build on their strengths. You know, if an employee comes up to you and asks how they could have done this project better, you know, taking the time to really think about what better performance would look like, and then giving them some ideas on how they can build upon the strengths that they have.
Well, in today's workplace, today's economy, there have been literally thousands of lawyers who've lost their positions in law firms, and the morale of a number of law firms have been dramatically impacted for the negative. So if somebody's worried, for example, about their job, what would you say the leader, the managing partner, should say or do in terms of this concept of honesty?
Well, again, it really does come down to honesty. What I have seen happen all too often is that the leader feels that he or she has to get up there and say, okay, people, we've done all the layoffs we're going to do. And then, you know, they lose a big client a week later and three more heads are chopped. You have to really just be very forthright and say, we feel like for now things have stabilized. We're going to focus on growing our practice, and we need all hands on deck to do that. So just really avoiding any false promises, because, you know, if you go back to, you know, 9/11, which was just a horrific time in our country, I mean, nobody could have predicted what would have happened as a result of 9/11. And we saw industries tank all around, you know, including the travel industry and, you know, I mean, it just happened all over. There was a rippling effect. So we don't really know what the future will bring. So really resist making any promises that you can't really control.
In other words, don't say something like, no new taxes, read my lips.
Exactly.
Okay. What's the biggest mistake that you see leaders make when it comes to the management of their people?
One of the biggest mistakes that I see, Ed, is really failing to hire for fit and instead hiring, you know, just based on credentials. And we have a lot of really talented people out there, and there's a lot of really smart people, but that doesn't mean that they'll necessarily fit well into your organization.
When you talk about fit, what are you talking about? In terms of their talents, or in terms of their work ethic, or in terms of firm culture? What are we talking about when you talk about
fit? We're talking work ethic. We're talking firm culture. You know, what is the type of employee who's going to fit best with your clients? Because, you know, some of your listeners might be, many of your listeners probably have some very prominent Fortune 500 companies. who may not be the right match for somebody who is more comfortable working with entrepreneurs or in the manufacturing industry.
Well, I remember years ago, John Wooden, a basketball coach for UCLA and one of my heroes, said something to the effect that he never recruited a player based on the fact that they were a center, a guard, or a forward. He recruited them only based on their work ethic, their morality, if you will, which was a big thing for him, and their overall skill on the court, irrespective of the position that they played. Is that what you're talking about, or analogous to that when you're talking about fit?
Yes, very much so. And I talk about this a lot when I train leaders on how to hire for fit, because, you know, the type of person that will fit well into a law firm, it's a very different type of person than if, let's say, you and I were trying to recruit somebody for a startup high-tech company. I mean, it just requires a different level of attention to detail, which is critical for those that are working in law firms. It requires a lot of stamina because you could be working through all hours of the night, you know, especially if a big case is coming up. It requires integrity because you have information that you can't share. I mean, there's a whole bunch of traits that when we hire for at law firms that we specifically look for. And somebody might be a really great candidate, but that doesn't necessarily mean they're really great for you.
Well, you've listed three of the factors that one might look at. And as you suggest, there are other factors as well. How does a hiring individual know? How do you ferret out enough information to say, well, they have integrity or they don't? They have the work ethic or they don't? They have the this or they don't? I mean, I know I've been coaching lawyers now for over 20 years, and in terms of the hiring, I perceive that's probably my worst failing. My attitude sort of is I'll hire somebody who appears to be okay and watch them for the first 30 days, say, or whatever it might be, and let them have enough rope to hang themselves. But I never have the confidence when I'm making a hire that I know that that person's going to succeed. And in fact, I think that's the tradition in the legal community, because law firms hire recent law school graduates by the droves, at least they used to, and then what the process that they, the word that they use for the process is they cull from that group. They wait and see and watch the performance of the individuals, that they have no real confidence that they've hired the right person. So what test can you suggest, or what method can you suggest that will give us a greater likelihood of success in the hiring process?
Well, Ed, what you just described is really a very expensive way to select people.
Amen.
Because, as you and I both know, all it takes is one bad experience and a client will, you know, take his or her business elsewhere.
Well, not only that, but the law firms literally have done the cost analysis, and for every lawyer that they let go after, say, a couple of years, they literally can put a number to it, and that number is somewhere between $400,000 and $500,000 that it costs them to terminate that individual.
Wow, well, that's a lot of money, and I'll tell you how you figure this out. I was working with a very large organization who was having similar challenges as far as finding the right people, and over my 25 years of experience, I've done a lot of work around talent selection. And I put together, Ed, a book called Selecting for Success, The Complete System for Hiring Top Talent. And you can download that from my website, or you can purchase a hard copy at yourhrexperts.com. And I will guarantee you that if you follow the steps that I've outlined in this book, you will improve significantly and reduce the cost of what's happening in your organization as far as turnover.
Well, that's good to know. Can you give us a couple of clues without reading the whole book, maybe one or two now?
Absolutely. Again, it comes down to fit. And so what do we look for? First, we look at who are the most successful people in our organization, because when we look at who they are and we analyze what traits they have in common, it becomes pretty clear to us exactly what type of person works best in the organization. And then by doing that, we build the platform so that when we're interviewing, we use what we call behavioral-based interviewing questions. And that is based on the fact that the best predictor of future performance is current and past performance.
Very good.
So we ask questions in a way, Ed, that it's not just about what is the question I should be asking, it's how do I interpret what I'm hearing?
Right.
Because people will tell you whatever you want to hear. But it's more about, well, are they really telling me what I want to hear, or are there other clues that aren't matching up?
A poor man's solution to what you're talking about was triggered in my mind when you responded by suggesting we look at the traits of successful people in our organization. And the poor man's approach to this is to talk to the people in your organization and tell them to go get friends and relatives and so forth that they know who would be interested in working in our firm doing XYZ job, whatever it might be. But if you have successful people out there doing the work for you, that is looking for other good people to bring into your organization, in my experience, the chances of success are increased. And then there's that buddy system that nobody wants to let down their buddy, so they're gonna work hard to make sure that they're successful in the new job that they've been hired for.
And that's a great way, Ed, of doing it. I would just caution your listeners to be a little bit careful, because we do know that like hires like. So, for example, you know, I have my undergraduate degree from Northeastern. And the people that I hang out with are of a similar age to me and a similar race. And, you know, and so we tend to hire people who look like us when, you know, as we're looking at building a more, you know, diverse workforce, and as we're more of a global organization, we want to make sure that we're just very aware that, you know, that does come into play.
Well, let me switch gears just a little bit, and I know that over the years I've come to learn and believe that money does not equate A, to employee happiness, nor B, to success. And if money, assuming we're competitive in the marketplace, so we're not, you know, underpaying significantly, what else is really important to prospective employees besides their pay?
I think in today's world, and especially as we look at younger attorneys coming in to the workplace, I think it's really about work-life balance, because these people who are coming in today, they've been raised by the baby boomers. And I do a lot of work, Ed, with the generations in the workplace. And these kids who are no longer kids, they're the latchkey kids. And they have sworn, just like we have, to do things differently. And so they're not going to make the same mistakes as their parents. And so when they're looking at coming to work for a firm, they want to make sure that there's some life balance.
Well, that
and they're willing to give up the money for it.
That leads us to a whole different discussion, because in my own opinion, I don't think there is such a thing as work-life balance. And what I see in today's world is that even the young people are very happy just to have a job, and they're going to work harder than what they might have done but for the financial crises that we've experienced. And I'll tell you, from my perspective, I think work, to use the phrase work-life balance, because that's what people understand, though I don't like the phrase. I think you're right that that's important. What I find to be perhaps more important than that is, for lawyers anyway, not necessarily for staff, but for lawyers, it's very important that the firm have a very good education program for continuing education, because the law schools just aren't doing it. And lawyers, young lawyers, know that if they want to advance in the firm or go out on their own ultimately and develop their own practice, they've got to have more education than what they got out of 3 years in law school. Have you seen any of that?
Well, I think that's important. I totally agree. But the one point that I do want to push back a little on, Ed, is that, you know, there's a difference between being happy to have a job and being happy in the job you're in.
Mm-hmm.
And I see a lot of lawyers today who are very, very happy to have a job. But I would venture to say that many, many of those people are not necessarily happy in their job.
Oh, I agree with you.
And as soon as this economy kicks back into full gear, I think that you're going to see, you know, people exiting firms left and right, which, again, if you go back to your number of $400,000 to $500,000 a person, I mean, you're just going to see, I mean, that just, it's going to be just, it's going to be just amazing what it's going to cost firms to lose these great people.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I mean, when I work with lawyers to sell the practice, especially the sole practitioners in the small firms, the baby boomers, they want to get out. They don't think they have anything to sell, and I have to educate them that they do. And then we start talking about, well, how do you get to that position? What is it that you're unhappy about? Can we do something to make you happy? Can we change the way you practice law to make you less stressed? And ultimately, when they want to get out, they don't have the rainbow at the end that they anticipated just a few years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And that dynamic makes them sometimes even more unhappy than they otherwise would be.
Absolutely.
But you've got to learn how to be happy where you are. There's an expression that I wish I could quote verbatim, but it's not what happens to you, but what you do with what happens to you,
mm-hmm,
that causes you to be happy or unhappy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think too few lawyers, even the young ones, are taught that skill, because we always felt the next generation would be better than we are, have more than we have, be more intelligent, and have more opportunities than we had, and so forth. And my kids and the kids after that just may not have that continuing cycle. They may have to learn to deal with what they have.
That's very true. That's very true. And I think what's so interesting about this younger generation that's coming in, you know, because both you and I are at the age where some of us have raised them. I'm still raising mine. We've taught them that, you know, anything is possible. And so they may very well skip the corporate route and hang their own shingles. It'll be interesting to see what happens.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you the, I guess, $64 question, if I'm showing my age a bit, instead of the $64 million question, and that is, what are some of the tips you can give us to create a workplace where people will consistently provide the level of service that clients should expect and need to get?
It's a great question, Ed. I mean, it comes really down to giving people an opportunity to have their voice, to have their voices heard, and asking for their opinions, and actually then taking those opinions and utilizing them and giving them credit for those great ideas. It comes down to recognizing people and acknowledging the type of work that they're doing, and in particular doing so in front of senior partners or even in front of clients. And it also comes down to treating people with respect and, you know, not like they're a commodity, not like, you know, you need to be billing your 2,000 hours in order for us to keep you. I think, you know, people just really want to feel like they're engaged and that they're valued and that they're learning. And you brought that up earlier. I think the learning is really key.
You mentioned earlier the idea of generations, and we've heard a lot about generation, you know, Gen Y, Gen X, millennial generation, and so forth. What should we consider when managing the employees, if you will, the attorneys, the staff of the various generations? For the first time in the history of our society, as best we can determine, there is the very large likelihood that any given law firm will have four generations of people in it. How do we manage those that variety, that diversity of age in a uniform way? Or are you saying perhaps that each generation and each person within the generation has to be individually and separately managed and treated?
Well, that's a really good question, Ed, and I talk about this a lot when I do keynotes on the generations in the workplace and how to leverage these generational workforce differences into opportunities. And here's what I tell people. It comes down to, first of all, having an understanding of where people are coming from. So if you understand each generation and what was what were some of the moments in those generations that made these people who they are today, if we begin by just having an understanding, then we can, you know, quickly move towards moving to the place where we recognize that although there are differences, there are more commonalities. And by that I mean, you know, everybody wants to be treated with respect. Everybody wants to be heard. You know, everybody wants to be recognized. I mean, that is common throughout the generations.
Mm-hmm.
So really focusing on, you know, what it is that, you know, your team really needs. And I do hesitate when I talk about the generations to put people in boxes. And we do that only just to demonstrate briefly that, you know, this is what this group is all about. This is what they're known for. Now let's open the box and see what's inside.
And I suppose, bottom line, we have to recognize that every person is an individual. And if you look at the differences between men and women, I remember reading many years ago the fact that men have some feminine qualities and women have some masculine qualities, or what were perceived to be those qualities of the other sex. And you have to really address each individual individually. And as your firm grows larger, that becomes a very, very difficult challenge. And putting people in boxes is just an easy way to get through the day sometimes. But it's a dangerous way to do it, I suppose, is what your message is.
Well, I think it's good to just get them in there, figure it out, open up the box, see what it's all about, and throw the box out.
Okay.
So you're not cluttered.
Okay. Well, Roberta, I want to thank you for joining us today. Your insights, I think, are outstanding, remarkable, and I think that our listeners need to pay heed to the people side of their organization, because after everything is said and done, their real assets walk out the door every night, and the hope is that they return the following morning. And only by having a firm culture that values the individual will that actually happen. And I want to encourage our listeners to read your new book, Suddenly in Charge, Managing Up, Managing Down, Succeeding All Around. I think it's a brilliant book and well worth the read. Roberta, thank you again for joining us.
Thank you, Ed.
You have been listening to a Law Biz podcast. For more podcasts, please visit www.lawbiz.com/podcasts.html. You can read more about this and other topics from the business of law at www.lawbizblog.com, or start your own discussion about this topic at www.lawbizforum.com. Join today. Feel free to tell your friends and colleagues about Law Biz podcasts. You may duplicate this program in part or in whole, provided that you retain appropriate attribution and copyright notices.